Welcome back once again. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are breaking down the language in the world, teaching people how to persuade. Seems like they need it. A little training here and there. I'm Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, late night comedy writer, which is going to tag in today with the guy we're going to be talking to today, ultimate late night comedy writer, I like to call him. The podcast, we talk to comedians. I convert the conservative right because I think they're wrong. And I talk to message pros, which is my guest today is a comedian and he's also a message pro. And I've known him for quite a while. Interesting guy. Greek, has one of the largest Greek craniums. Like his head is, what is it about the Greeks and head size? It's amazing. So welcome. He's written Late Night Forever, originally from New York, has some chocolate in his background, right? Come from a chocolate family.
That's correct, Dan.
That's correct. Peter Charkalis. Peter, what's up, buddy?
Hey, Dan. Good to see you again. Can I tell you a funny story about you? You're talking about the size of my head. I had to get a passport photo taken about 20 years ago.
You had to get a panorama shot?
No, what happened was they cut off my head. It was too big, so I had to go back and take it again. So I have to live with that.
They say like all the stars have oversized heads. Like that's one of the things.
I don't know. Does that mean bigger brains?
No, it's just something about like the size of people's faces on screens. Like if you look at most of the film stars, they're actually really big faced people.
They're big faced people, but on little bodies, because most stars and celebrities are much smaller than you think in real life.
As are you. You're much smaller than I think.
Yes, I am. I am.
Run your background for people just a little bit so we can orient. Tell people who Peter Charkalis really is.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a quick highlight tour. So it's true. I do come from a chocolate background. I was in the family chocolate business, which still exists today in upstate New York and around Poughkeepsie area. And I was looking for something to do and I found an ad for Toastmasters. And you know what Toastmasters is, right?
It's the mastery of toast.
Yes, it is. It is an international organization, let's say, where people can practice their public speaking under no pressure. You could go to, like, for example, a club could be holding a meeting in the back of a restaurant, you know, and you prepare a speech and then you would evaluate my speech. And then there's time for a spontaneous talking, etc. Anyway, it's just designed.
It's super odd that came about as a phenomenon. It's kind of like Arthur Murray dance classes. Yeah, you know, like right. I taught public speaking in college for a long time, but there was a professional organization, Toastmasters, that just grew up where ordinary people would go to be able to do that. That's kind of odd.
Yeah, well, it's sort of professional because what's the there's another professional organization that's teaches people.
Well, there's the Dale Carnegie stuff. And
that's what I was thinking. Yeah. That's more sales oriented, I think.
How to spin friends and manipulate people or whatever it was.
But Toastmasters was more like anybody could join. You get up and you speak and you go at your own pace, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I did a character, it was a tall tales contest. I did a Greek character, got some laughs. Oh, somebody said, why don't you go in a comedy club? It'd be funny. I did that.
It was a Greek character, right?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up with the accent. I mean, I was born here, but my aunts and uncles all had the accent. So I did a spoof. And so then I started going to open mics. And it, you know, it stood out because nobody was doing it was sort of like the Greek Yakov Smirnoff, if you will.
Sure.
If I could say that.
Yeah, you were one of the early, there's a character slotting in stand-up. Like if you can catch a little wave in there that people like, it's right. Like My Big Fat Greek Wedding and all that sort of romantic comedies within each ethnic genre. So yeah, there's a space for that in entertainment.
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is other comics kind of resented it at times.
Sure.
Because I wasn't being true or organic, you know, they didn't like, it was too sticky.
Yeah, no, but, totally. That's one of the things about weird about stand-up is that it's so underprofessionalized, you know, out in the middle of the country that nobody wants to actually do entertainment in it.
Right.
You want to deny that they're entertainers.
Yeah. And there's no professional training. Just get up and no one takes you by the side, you know, and tells you how to do it unless you want to pay someone or coach, but there's no school for it. So you just get up and the bottom line is if the club owner thinks you can make the audience laugh, they hire you, you know? So I met people through stand up and found that you could fax jokes to Jay Leno. This is early 90s. I started submitting to Leno. I sold some stuff. I couldn't crack the nut though. I couldn't get to the staff position, even though I hammered away. I did the same with Letterman, and then Letterman had his heart episode, and I didn't know who to send stuff to. And I was, oh, there's this new guy, Kilbourne, who's following Letterman now at 12:30. I should give him a shot. So I started sending jokes to him, and I got confident selling to Leno and Letterman. I figured if I could sell to Letterman, especially, who rejects everything, I would be good.
So, do you remember the first joke you sold to Letterman?
Monica Lewinsky joke.
What was it?
It was during the Olympics, and I can't remember the setup, but the idea was earlier today, President Clinton gave an intern a score of 9.8.
That's great. I tell people that there's a few things about you that are examples that I tell people when I teach like comedy writing and late night writing and stuff like that, because you write a couple of jokes very well, a couple of forms of jokes very well. And you're to me like a mechanic of those kind of jokes. Like, you know that structure super well. And I learned, like, the first joke I sold to Letterman was, this is back when Barack Obama had just been outed for still smoking cigarettes every once in a while. And the president of Iran had just rigged the elections again and gotten like 99.7% of the vote. And so the joke was, Barack Obama's really upset about this, the Iran elections being rigged. He vowed to never smoke camels again. And the structure of Letterman is to take two disparate news stories, crash them together at the very end of the joke.
Right.
Good at that.
I always try. That was number one. I just noticed that most of the monologues are written that way anyway, because they have to hit as many topics in as short a period of time as possible. So that's what I always look for first. Literally would have two lists and say, oh, what connections can I make?
Well, that's why I sometimes describe you, I think, as a mechanical writer, not in a bad way at all, but like some people do it all just in the back of their heads and never think about it. But you would tend to put it out in front of you. I could walk into your office at Kilbourne and it was just, you know, all this stacks of newspapers and magazines and things, because you externalize it so that you can see it and then you write it back into the computer, I think.
Yeah. You know, everybody's got a different style. I was sort of a combination of that mechanical part and, you know, trying to be flexible and see what happens. But yeah, there was that. And then from Letterman, he was really short and clipped. He liked them. So I tried to, you know, economize with the wording and all that. Leno was more observational. I mean, you learn from all of them. They all have things about all the hosts. You learn different things.
Leno's a softer joke, right? I mean, he's a rounder joke. It's not that sharp pop, pop, pop.
Right, right. Not as traditional, but yeah, you just learn. I mean, it took me like, I sold a couple jokes to Leno right off the bat, and it took me 7 months before I sold another one. And I just wasn't paying attention. And finally, I got lucky. And finally, the light clicked. Oh, I see what he's doing. Okay, that's his voice. So it just, the light goes on at different times. You just have to do it a lot.
Well, Leno was the original famous fax taker location. That's how it seems like every other stand-up would claim I write for Leno because they wrote for the fax pool.
They sold three jokes and they claimed they were a staff writer or something like that. Exactly. But it was great. I mean, he provided opportunities for people, you know, to sort of get their start and get their confidence. So that was good.
I guess it's against the Writers Guild policy to do facts and jokes now, or even if it was, and I think maybe it was then, but they weren't enforcing it.
It was back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. You weren't.
They just, to. Yeah, they just don't enforce that stuff, but.
Right. And I have no idea now which shows take material. I don't even know if any of them take it, to be honest with you.
So you faxed into Leno, then you start faxing to Letterman, and then you start faxing into Kilbourne. And that's when you got interested as a staff writer.
Yeah. And Diana and I were living in Alexandria, Virginia at the time. And she was pregnant. And so.
The kid that you're taking to college this week.
Exactly. Incredible. And so, she was home and she got the call. And came over to where I was working and said, you know, they call and would want to know if you want to move to LA to write on this TV show.
And wait a minute, they told her that?
She got the call at home. I wasn't home.
Oh, well, I mean, a voicemail, or they called and said, hey, you think your husband would want to move here?
I think she talked to Mike Gibbons. I think she actually talked to him. I thought it was kind of weird.
That is weird.
Yeah. So. Yeah, well, of course we said yes. We packed up and we moved here in 2001. So we had the job, the baby, and the house. We did it all at one time. So we got to stress things out of the way.
It's been smooth sailing ever since then.
Oh, of course, yeah. Really smooth.
You literally moved like the week of 9/11?
Yes, we flew out. The Friday, I think it was like the 8th or 9th or something like that. And my first day of work was September 10th. And there was an earthquake in Los Angeles that weekend. I remember we were doing earthquake jokes. And then I remember getting up the next morning trying to call my parents to tell them about my first day at work. And I couldn't get through. They were in New York. I couldn't get through. And then they tell me what happened. It's like, so I walked into work and I just said, okay, go home and then we'll figure it out. And as I recall, for 2 weeks, the late night hosts sat at their desks mm-hmm. and had guests and talked, but there were no monologues or comedy bits for 2 weeks.
Yeah, they took out comedy for 2 weeks. It was crazy. I remember watching that and thinking, you know, when you get that much drama suddenly injected into the world, you know, comedy shrinks down. And it's like, I start thinking about during wars and Vietnam and things like that. How would you do, like, does the comedy always shrink during a war? And then it kind of slowly comes back when people don't, when the world doesn't end, you know, so it's.
Yeah. Obviously, there's no formula for that. You know, why 2 weeks? Like, it felt right, I guess. And then, you know, now it's 20 years later, and people will mention 9/11 sometimes. And here's an example of a comedy. A speaker, I was hired to write some lines for a speaker, and they sent me examples of jokes he had done. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. And there's this old joke about this dog who can speak. And the punchline is, well, he's a liar too, or something like that. But in the setup, he says, yeah, they came across this dog and he was, sniffing around the ground zero of the towers. And I'm thinking, you said that in a setup? Really?
Wow.
No clue whatsoever. And they didn't like the jokes I sent. I mean, it was a total disconnect about what's appropriate. And I had researched where this guy was speaking and done all this stuff. And what they wanted were, their version of a joke was, three guys walk into a bar, a lawyer, you know, that. Anyway.
How do people, those jokes were all those street jokes were written by somebody, right?
Yeah.
They came from like Playboy magazine and, you know, all those places where jokes used to just joke writers didn't have a place to put jokes. So they would put them in places like that and they would eventually make out into street jokes. But how do you write that? Like, how did two guys walk into a bar become the structure?
Who was the first guy or gal that came up with that? That's what I always think about. It's like, what was the first conversation on earth, and what happened after that? And who wrote the first jokes? You know, I don't know.
I always wanted to get a society joke, like a culture echo joke, like that everybody kind of knows, like just leave it. It's going to be there 50 years from now when you're dead and gone, the joke's still alive.
The joke is still alive. It sounds like the name of a book or something. I don't know.
So you've done a lot of that. Your career has mostly been writing for other people. You've still done some stuff on stage, but mostly you've been the guy behind the guy, you know, writing jokes.
Yeah, I did Ferguson replaced Kilbourne. And then I didn't have a staff job for a while. It was a few years I freelanced. I went back to selling to Letterman again and occasionally Saturday Night Live, other comedians. I wrote for George W. Bush and Obama impersonators. And that's what the right gets wrong about comedy. They think, oh, you're all ultra left and liberal. Hey, whatever's funny at the time, that's what we go for. You mean to tell me there were no Clinton intern jokes? You know, if Trump is going to do his stuff, of course people are going to go after him.
Yeah, comedy works either direction. It's harder going down, like when I wrote for Dennis Miller, that he wouldn't do pro-liberal jokes, but you didn't have to write the pro-conservative jokes. He would just add that stuff.
Right.
He liked jokes, and it could be about politics, but we didn't have to go around, you know, trying to write, hey, what a great guy George Bush is for him. He just added that.
But didn't he go really right after a while?
Like, oh, incredibly far right. When I was at CNBC, he was totally zealot, totally Fox News, gone to the right. But all his staff was still the same guys that had written for him forever. You know, a bunch of Hollywood liberals.
Right. I always get mad when I hear the rights complaining about, oh, it's all the, you know, liberal. No, it's just what, if people are going to mess up, that's what you go for. It doesn't matter.
It's normal humans. Like, just take the word liberal out and just say normal, you know, like regular people just writing jokes. I don't care about the politics.
Yeah. No, you care about the laugh and finding the great line and all that will make people laugh. At least maybe resonate.
So you've written for TV monologue guys. You've written for stand-ups. You've written for speakers. You've probably done it all. You've probably written greeting cards at some point, I would imagine.
I'm doing that now. I'm doing that now, actually. You know, during the pandemic, it's hard to find work. I gotta keep the muscle going. And so who could I send jokes to? Just like sit down and just send them all. There's nothing complicated. Oh, I found a greeting card company that accepted them. So, you know, I can say I'm working.
You wrote for comic strips too, right? Didn't you do that for a little while?
I did. I wrote with Dan Bliss. I don't think I got his first name right. Bliss. He's a syndicated columnist, had a cartoon in the LA Times, but also sold jokes to the New Yorker. So I wrote, he drew, of course, and I was thrilled to get something in the New Yorker.
Yeah, that's a cool credit.
Yeah, and then it dried up, and then I read last year that now Steve Martin is writing with him. So, not that I personally got bumped for Steve Martin, but I thought that was interesting that someone of Steve Martin's caliber is now doing that.
Yeah, you know, I got my first job in Hollywood was writing for Yakov Smirnoff.
Oh, right.
And, you know, I got flown down to his theater in Branson for a week and wrote jokes for him. And he was looking, he just went through writers constantly to try to get anybody that could actually, you know, put up with him, I think. And they would go to famous writers and he would spend a ton of money. And then he would go to like some good writer and not, the only thing he could recognize was the fame credits, like not the actual quality of the material.
Right.
So there were times when, you know, like, yeah, I watched people who were his writers. His original writers were the guys, the brothers who ran The Simpsons.
Really?
Yeah, I can't remember their names right now, but like, you remember the joke, the Miller Lite joke in Russia. You know, here you go to the party in Russia, the party comes to you or goes after you.
Yeah.
That was those guys. They wrote those one-liners for him.
It wasn't the Letterman. You were brothers, you said, right?
Yeah.
I don't remember who they were.
I can't remember their name, but they were the Simpsons. Really super talented writers. So you never know, like, who is behind that guy, you know, that person up there on stage.
You don't. And I'm always amazed that people think a lot of times late night hosts are thinking of that stuff on the fly. When there's like a dozen writers cranked out 200 or 300 jokes and they're picking out the best ones. Like, no, these guys aren't that good.
Well, that's what I talk about in my stuff about rhetoric, that rhetoric is designing messages, heightening them and amplifying them so that they will work when you do persuasion. So it doesn't matter if it's politics or sales or whatever you're doing. You want the best messages. They're going to work with that target audience. And comedy writers are great at that. Like, you can adjust your voice to the audience that you're trying to target, and you can adjust your writing voice to the person that's going to be talking to that audience. And you can hear that stuff. Like, the ear of most really good comedy writers is just amazing to me. And it's rare for people to be able to adjust their voice across, you know, those type of locations.
Yeah, you have to listen for subtleties, you know, nuances of the person you're writing for and what do they like to do. Like, Letterman always used to like to incorporate New York City or how cold the Ed Sullivan Theater was. Or he would talk about his fake hairpiece. He wrote so many hairpiece jokes, but he never had one. I never got that. What it was about the hairpiece, but I'm not going to complain.
Letterman's so idiosyncratic. There's things that he just finds funny.
Yeah.
That was the hard part for me writing for him, is that he would write news of the day jokes and then he wouldn't do any of the news at all.
Right. He would just do jokes about squirrels and their nuts in Central Park or whatever.
It's you have like a great joke that you wrote for Letterman. And again, it's this kind of super structured joke with really great intuition about the exact right thing to put in there. And Letterman also liked that structure of, like you said, weather jokes.
Yeah.
Or whatever, that bait and switched you at the very end. And the joke was, I think it was 50, it's like 53 and gloomy today in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I can't remember who it was I was making fun of.
Yeah, you're, oh, no, wait, that's Mel Gibson.
Yeah, right, exactly. That's Mel Gibson, right. I always was so excited to see when a temperature and a weather forecast fits somebody, you know? yeah.
Well, and that's part of it, knowing all those formats that work and then just waiting for the right cultural moment for those to line up.
Yeah.
There's a guy
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, there's a guy, Kilbourne, I can't remember his name, is Chris something. He came in late and he had a joke structure. And you always, once you do your joke structure, everybody else is going to use it too. But his was like blank 422 human zero, you know?
Oh, okay. Right. I've used that a few times. Yeah, that's easy to remember, I guess.
Yeah.
It's snappy, you know, it gets to the point real quick.
Yeah. Like, I'm doing my thing lately has just been to, I get super interested in, I think I have comedy OCD. I get interested in a topic and I deep dive on it, all the trivia about it. And then I turn that into stand-up.
Right.
And the most recent one is the Titanic. Like, it's just so dense with trivia that it's kind of fun to go in and start playing around with it and turning it into stand-up. And there was one there about, like, you know, they challenged God. God himself could not sink this ship. And God's like, really? Have you heard of ice? Because I'm going to sink you into the water with harder water.
Right.
And it's like God, you know, God 4,000,000,000,6321, you know, humanity zero or whatever.
Right. What made you get into that? Dive into that topic.
I just finished a book called Invincible Talk. It's a persuasion book. Invincible Talk, winning in the 21 Coliseums of Persuasion. And so I'm writing a stand-up version of it.
Cool. cool.
Yeah. And so I got off on that word invincible. Like, you got to be careful using that word. Just ask the people from the Titanic.
Right. Exactly. Right. There you go.
And then my brain goes, you know, I don't really know anything about that Titanic. When did the thing actually sink? And so you start researching, you realize you've known about that big event your whole life, but you don't know hardly any of the details.
No, you don't. And it didn't sink right away, right? It took a while to sink.
2 hours and 40 minutes.
Yeah, you'd think that would be enough time to get out of that, but it wasn't.
There was enough time to get out. They didn't have enough lifeboats.
Right. Yeah. That's, oh man.
Plus everybody, you know, in the third deck couldn't really get to the top.
Right. I wanted to talk about, you know, G. Gordon Liddy died. Do you know that?
I did not.
He passed away. And the reason I'm bringing him up is because I'm thinking of rhetoric and talking and people. And so he was 90. And my mother went to high school with him. And Diana's father was friends with him. And Diana, my wife, and Diana's dad had some kind of difficulty. He was the head of some environmental thing, and he got demoted because a deer was killed on a property, and the guys mishandled. And so ultimately, he took the hit for it. G. Gordon Liddy wrote a letter from prison telling him that if he needed any help, he could jump in.
Really?
Yes. But here's a guy who said he felt an electric surge when he heard Adolf Hitler on the radio. And I think, first of all, who listens to Adolf Hitler on the radio?
Right? How do you find Adolf Hitler on the radio these days?
Does he have his own podcast that's just in perpetuity or something? I don't know. But here's the guy was such a zealot, right? That's how you pronounce it.
I would say zealot.
Yeah, zealot. And then later in life, he turned to debating Timothy Leary. They were at total odds. And I guess that's a marketing thing, I guess, of the last few years, is you debate your opponent and then you can, you know, make some money from it.
Yeah, Marr was going around with, I think, Dennis Miller for a while.
Oh, that makes sense.
Like that.
There were compadres coming up probably through the stand-up. But anyway, I brought that up.
Well, you look at guys like this. So you go through these epics, you know, these epics of politics. So the 70s, you know, the Watergate and, you know, the G. Gordon Liddy's and like all the Reagan stuff and the Sandinistas and the selling arms on the black market. Everybody just forgets that stuff.
Right.
You know, it just washes away now until the next big wave of stuff comes along. Like, yeah. He can barely even remember George Bush and Dick Cheney anymore. Trump just came up with his circus and just washed it all away.
He really did. And he's not going to go away too quickly, at least not in Georgia or the Southern District of New York.
Yeah, he's got a different venue these days.
He does.
Have you written a bunch? Like, we were both out of full-time staff writing when Trump arrived. Can you imagine like just the amount of Trump jokes you would write for like Colbert?
Oh my God. You know, I wondered if it was hard or easy because with all the shit that he said, you know, how can you make fun of stuff that's already weird? But there was so much of it that you do it. Yes, you could find things to make fun of, you know, whether it's him or his cronies or his party or whatever.
Yeah, I wrote about him throughout the whole time. Like, I've continued to write just for my own stuff and just because I enjoy it, and I throw it on Twitter all the time. And my stuff has become a mix of, sometimes I'll do just a straight political angle, you know, sort of an explanatory angle that I find interesting. And then, but usually 90% of the time I put a joke in it.
Right.
And I really enjoyed writing about Trump. He was such a sideshow. There was, and you could take such strong shots at him because he was taking such strong shots at everybody.
Yep. And I will say this for the listening and viewing audience, that you had really funny jokes on Facebook about Trump. Probably the best. I put some up there, but I know I had mixed feelings about Facebook. It's like, I don't know, you know, if I want to put them out there. I don't want to get sucked into the whole political, you know, I'm getting all angry and spending time on Facebook. It was hard for me to separate the anger sometimes and the joke. My heart would be in it, and I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to write the jokes.
I kind of wrote myself out of all that. Once you write about it so much, you know, yeah, you lose all the emotion.
Right.
And I was never a political writer. Like, I was never a political comedian or anything like that. And even with rhetoric, I didn't really do political rhetoric until Trump showed up and got in my face and just busted the pinata of politics across the entire world.
Right.
Then he's like, okay, if you want to try that, then I will see if I can marshal forces over here to answer you. Like, just imagine if they would have a really good shock comic or a really good, like a Dave Attell or one of these guys as a moderator at a presidential debate.
Oh, that would be so great.
It would change everything.
Right. It would put people in their rightful places.
Well, you can't lie to those guys.
Right.
You can't be this kind of pitter-patter politics and bullshit and all that. They will shred you.
Right. What do you think about the media and Trump? In other words, you know, they want to report the truth. They know the guy, he's a reality show host who built his empire on the coattails of his dad. You know, he's been sued. So the press reports on him. CNN knows that they're going to get eyeballs. So it's a matter of, like, it's business versus journalism. It's all, everything is overlapping and gray. You know, I wouldn't watch CNN after a while, even though I agreed with him. It was just so much of this stuff, a deluge every day. And I almost wanted to hear CNN maybe just give the other point of view or do a Colbert and have a mock, you know, conservative person and in turn make fun of them. I don't know. It became too much for me.
Yeah. The entertainment news and the news industry and journalism and in general was not ready for somebody like Trump. They're not prepared for it. They didn't have answers to it. They didn't have practices and norms and policies in place for what to do when somebody with status, political, governmental status, the president, is standing there and blatantly lying to everybody. And you start to see towards the end of his tenure up there, they started taking shots at him.
Right.
And then, you know, he would pivot away or he would bitch and he started leaving the press conferences.
Right.
And the tradition of respecting the office got in the way of journalism, clearly.
It's true. It's very
Again,
true.
Why not a room full of stand-up comics asking them questions?
Those guys wouldn't know how to handle a heckler, and they wouldn't know how to handle heckles from professional comedians. Trump is so thin-skinned and insecure. He would probably just walk off the stage, you know, after, you know, one question or something.
Well, he did the whole last year of his presidency, like walking out on Leslie Stahl and walking out, whatever. It didn't matter. He couldn't handle it at all. So he'd gotten to the point where psychologically they had broken through his bubble some and started getting a little bit of voices in there. And it was just a little, and he couldn't handle any of it. But I think the press has kind of been trained now. Like, they're still doing fact checks. I'm like, you don't need to fact check Biden. He may overstate something.
Right.
You know, he may get something wrong, but right, you don't have to fact check him. He's not up there lying on purpose.
I wonder if they're doing that to show that they're consistent and not partisan. Maybe that's part of it. We're just doing our job. You know,
well, that's also the training of, again, I think it's very instructive to look at the training in stand-up versus the training in journalism, right? Journalists get trained to these ideas of fairness and balance and all that kind of stuff, whereas stand-ups don't. Stand-ups get trained to what's funny.
Exactly.
What's going to blow the room open?
Right. Yeah.
You know? And, you know, in a writer's room, half the time, the best jokes still get sanitized out of the show.
That's true. For many different reasons. Sometimes it might be because the joke is about a celebrity and the host is friends with that celebrity, or a writer's a friend, and or CBS, you know, there's so many reasons why.
But, do you ever have any jokes that you, do you remember that you really wanted on, but they hit too much of a button?
Oh boy, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I was surprised with some jokes that did get on the air. There was one about, I said, so can't say it now, but I was, this was for Kilborn. I was watching, you know, flipping through, and I was watching Connie Chung. Oh, and then I realized Greta Van Susteren had just had an eye tuck. And you can't do that joke now, right?
Yeah, the identity politics have gotten much more landmined.
Yeah.
You know, like I had a joke at Kilborn. This was an interesting joke that because of the reverberations of it politically on the show, but was Pete Rose finally admitted that he bet on baseball, but still refuses to admit he stole his hairstyle from a lesbian.
Right. Right.
And I wonder with that joke, if that would make it today.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because that's not a hard shot. That's a very soft, like it's nothing negative about lesbians. It's negative about him.
Right. It's an observation that lesbians have these haircuts. So you're not, your intent is not to demean or disrespect anyone. It's just sort of almost a statement. Well, you and I would say it's a statement of fact. Other people may differ.
Well, my, you know, I have a 21-year-old daughter and she's incredibly millennial and incredibly super sensitized to many of the identity politics issues. And I totally respect that, but I tell her, like, you are laying landmines out for me everywhere. Like, yeah, just using the words doesn't mean it should trigger your landmine. If I use the words from a certain social perspective and I'm anti something, then sure. But if I'm just talking about it or trying to be, you know, intellectual about it or trying to find a joke in it. Right. I did a joke once about Michael, Kirk Douglas was, when he was still alive, was on the Academy Awards. And this was after he'd had a stroke and was not doing well. I mean, he worked hard to come back. God bless him, the amount of work that man did to be able to talk again. But he was still hard to understand and didn't look right. And they did a bit on there where they had two ingenues helping him give an award. And they were hitting on him, or he was hitting on them. And again, couldn't do that now, but I was watching this and I turned to Quincy and she was maybe 10 or 12 at the time. And I'm like, he better hope that the Grim Reaper isn't watching the Academy Awards, because he's going to be like, oh, I forgot about that guy. And she got very upset. She's like, you can't talk about him like that. He's old. Right. I'm like, I want people talking about me like a regular human being when I'm old.
Right. Yeah. I'm all for
very landminey.
Yeah, landmine's a good phrase. It's just too much. I'm all for respect and being sensitive, but there comes a point where it's like, come on, people, this is just crazy. You got to be able to say stuff. And using a word doesn't necessarily mean you're insulting an entire race or, I don't know. But there's so many, you know, the thing is, there's a lot of gray areas. I guess that's what life is all about. How do you navigate?
Well, do you stay up with it? Do you feel like you would still be pertinent and able to write jokes about what's going on right now if you got plucked onto a staff again?
I think I could. I noticed that I've gone through periods of time where I haven't written anything. And then I'll start writing and I'll surprise myself, say, this isn't too bad. I thought I'd be really rusty. The only thing is catching up to what references are being used during that time. But other than that, I think the muscle, I don't think it atrophies. I know about how you feel about that, but it's still there.
Well, I've stayed on it. Like, again, I just enjoy it. So I write jokes every day and I'm on, I trained, you know, you get trained on the late night writing to watch the news and you're always looking for angles and your brain just naturally creates jokes. Right. So I stay up with the culture pretty well, but it's like digital culture. Like, do you know what an NFT is?
No.
So this is like the very leading edge of the digital culture right now. Do you know what Bitcoin is and all that?
I've heard of Bitcoin. Yeah, I know it. I sort of know it, but I don't know.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's all these little things within digital culture that, man, there's a lot to track there. But I've got an 18-year-old son who's very digital and my daughter stays up with it. So I can track some of it through them. But I, the other day I got my, I got more digital than my son. And he was like, what? How do you know that? And I'm like, the joke was something I'd seen that Bean Dad and Cereal Shrimp Guy both turned out to be milkshake ducks. Does any of that make sense to you?
No.
Three dominant stories in the digital universe.
No, I couldn't even pretend to laugh because I didn't get it.
But as soon as I saw it, because I stay up with that stuff, I'm like, oh, that's perfect. That's exactly right. And that's hilarious. But it's completely foreign if you don't, if you're not in that milieu.
Right. That's where
it's
I
not
probably
hard to catch up.
Yeah, you can catch up, but I think that's where we'd be at a disadvantage if you're on a staff. You have to replace, you can't use Keith Richards anymore or some other old technical term. You have to use whatever's, you know, the most current one.
And I have run into older comedy writers who I'm like, dude, I saw a guy the other day posted a John Kerry horse face joke. I'm like, hey, man,
come on.
step into the at least the 2015s, you know.
Right.
I'll tell you real quick so I don't leave you hanging. Bean Dad was a guy on Twitter who tortured his 10-year-old daughter because she didn't know how to open a can of beans and he wouldn't show her.
Oh, wow.
And so it took forever to figure it out. And everybody was amused by it at first, but then turns out he turned out to be an asshole, like with a bunch of right-wing posts. And then Shrimp Cereal Guy was a guy who had found two shrimp tails in a box of sugar cereal and they'd been sugar-fied. And he posted a picture of it and said, how did this happen? You know, my sugar cereal got shrimped. And then same thing, he turned out to have a bunch of right-wing ugly posts. And so Milkshake Duck is the original meme from like 2016. And a guy posted, this duck drinks milkshakes, which is really cute until you look at his old tweets. And he turns out to be a right-wing duck. He's a duck who loved Hitler. So you have these three things and they all come together that, oh, it's a milkshake duck.
So using those three, so you feel enough people would get those, like it's worth doing, like it would reach a broad audience with those three references.
Not a general TV audience, no. But a digital audience, sure.
Millennial audience, yeah, wow.
I follow maybe 1,500 to 2,000 people on Twitter who are joke writers. And they're clearly not professional joke writers, but they're really good joke writers. Mm-hmm. And the Twitter universe has all its own references and they'll put, you know, sort of setups out there and then they'll all write the same new punchlines to it.
Right.
And I find that's kind of my entertainment for myself on the side.
Yeah. I've seen those themes where it's Halloween or whatever or something. I go on Twitter once in a while, but I think I came to the party late and I thought, oh, I'm going to get on Twitter and I'm going to have so many people follow me and someone's going to see one of my jokes and going to hire my ass.
No, there's none of that.
And I think, none of that. No. And I think the people who got in early got a good following, but at some point, I don't think anybody could just start writing good stuff and then you would catch on.
No, it's not really the hiring field that most people would like it to be. But, you know, there's so few positions, there's so few writer jobs, and everybody's out there in Hollywood and stuff fighting for those jobs.
Yeah.
70% of them are absorbed by politics. You know, your story of faxing in and then maybe getting hired is that's a rarity.
Yeah, it's probably true. And also an old story. I mean, I don't know how people do it now. I think it's like maybe other businesses where you know somebody. I mean, that's true. That's a human nature thing. But I always objected when an agent said, okay, there's an opening on The Daily Show. Send your packet into Jon Stewart. And like, there's got to be hundreds of packets. There's no way that I'm going to stand out unless the agent has a connection to the host or I know the show. But if it's just a random packet, and you got to, you know, if you don't submit, then the agent isn't going to put you up for things. So you do it, you know, so you're stuck.
Do you know how I got hired at Kilbourne?
I think I do. I remember taking these jokes right here and then walking them over to the head writer and putting them on his desk. You're welcome.
Oh, I think I've thanked you many times.
You have. I know you have. I was just kind of doing the old Kilbourne type of thing, you know.
I kind of came up through your wake in a few different ways. Like, it started with the Complete Sheet. I took your old job at the Complete Sheet through Jan McGinnis before I knew you. Like, I was helping her learn how to write a sitcom. And you left for Kilbourne. And that job came open. And she's like, hey, do you want to apply for this job for writing for this radio show? And I'm like, sure. And she gave me Johnny's email. And I just sent him a bunch of jokes. I didn't apply or anything. I sent him 20 jokes. And I'm like, he bought 10 of them. And I was hired. So off we go.
Right.
And then you helped me get a packet into Kilbourne.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
And now we're both just following each other into oblivion.
Right. Talking about old things like faxing.
Fax had its day, man, with jokes. That was a thing. Everybody wanted to be a faxer.
Yeah, it's sort of like a retro thing. You know, it'd be kind of cool to say you're a faxer now. You know, it's like going back to vinyl.
Well, now it's Zoom. Everybody is writing off Zoom. It's like the same thing. You're working at home. Everybody's working at home.
Yeah. You know, I wrote on an award show a few months ago that was on Zoom. The Voice Arts Awards. And so they held it in a theater in New York. So the presenters were there, but there was no audience. So I wrote jokes for it. And man, they just didn't fly. There was no, and first of all, when people are on award shows and do jokes, usually few will land anyway. But there was just no audience, so there's no sense of timing or rhythm. It's like, oh, you really, I don't know if you want to use a joke writer for those kinds of award shows.
Yeah, you're missing, I mean, you're throwing the jokes into a chasm, you know, in that abyss. Nobody wants the abyss response. It's awful.
Yeah, and you feel bad. I mean, the joke may have been good, but you feel bad that it didn't get a laugh, and it's not really, you know, it's not your fault. I guess.
Well, you see things, if you start to, like, Zoom doesn't work for stand-up, it doesn't work for straight jokes like that, but when you look at places that have done similar things and developed some aesthetics for it, like Talk Soup, you know, the guys on Talk Soup would end up doing the jokes for the crew.
Right.
You know, and so they at least had somebody to interact with.
Right.
And you could kind of hear a response, and that gave it enough vitality that as long as they're moving fast, you know, it kind of worked.
Right.
But this complete dead Zoom to an open room, they've got to add in some type of response element.
I saw a comedian on Zoom and it was just terrible. And I don't know what they're doing now. I know there are virtual comedy shows. I mean, have they tweaked them in any way to make them funnier that you know of?
I don't know if you ever met my friend Claude Shires, who has a company that was doing live broadcasts from comedy clubs. Like, he had set up cameras in 5 or 6 different comedy clubs around the country and was selling tickets to live shows that you could watch online. And that was before the pandemic hit. But it was still the same sense of, how do you get enough of the live experience into the screen, you know, and into people's ears so that it gives you the emotion? And it's a struggle even with that. If you're trying to recreate the live experience, I don't think you're doing it right. I think one of the things I've learned about podcasting is even just having both of us on screen and going back and forth. So when I finish something, you pick it right up and you'll start talking. So there's no dead air. But you tell a joke and you're waiting for the response.
Waiting.
Dead air.
That's right.
And there's nothing more deadly to humans than silence in response to something somebody said.
Exactly. And then if you're the comedian and you know it's going to be dead air, your inclination might be to rush, which further makes it even more awkward. It just sort of destroys the entire rhythm of the performance.
How about we do a stand-up show and it's just a room full of crickets?
Oh, I've done that before many times.
Like real crickets.
Real crickets.
So bad that they start to boo.
The crickets. I wrote a joke somewhere along the line about, it was so bad I got heckled by a cricket.
Oh man, I miss the days of like sitting around with guys, like real comedy writers that just love the the meal, you know, just all the different elements, and it's like cooking together, right?
Right.
And suddenly somebody will throw something in there and it'll just explode everything. And everybody's like, oh, that's great. But it all came out of that milieu of just talking, you know, around a table.
Yeah, it did. And then I remember at Kilbourne, near the end of the day, you would come into my office and they would need more 5 questions. And I really enjoyed that. It was just, you know, us throwing out lines. And I think we got some on.
Yeah. I think finding that stuff, to me, finding different configurations like that to keep your creativity sort of cycling during the day. Like, I like going to my office and writing by myself for an hour, hour and a half. And you were really good at that. Like, you're not a particularly verbal in the room guy. You know, you're like Ted, what's his name?
Tall Ted. Yeah, I can't remember his name.
Ted Jessup. Ted Jessup. Yep. That guy was a Gatling gun, man. He just never shut up.
Right.
And, you know, 80% entertaining. I love to listen to the guy, but yeah. Most of the jokes you couldn't use because you need 95% and above and octane in the jokes. But he kept all the energy in the room, so.
He did. Yeah, some guys were, I recall the phrase was decent hang. The writer was a decent hang. However, he didn't get many jokes on, so in 13 weeks, his ass was out.
Yeah, because ultimately, it doesn't matter if somebody's a horrible hang. If they give you 5 useful jokes.
Right. Got to produce. That's why I didn't care about being on the inside track. I just want to go in and do my job and keep it. That's all I cared about.
Well, and I think, again, one of the things I learned from you is write a few type of jokes really, really well. And most of the guys on Kilbourne were younger writers. They weren't writing that kind of stand up and sort of old tradition setup punch that has a really hard punch in it. You know, they were clever and that kind of dance around the joke and, you know, give me a super arcane reference. And I learned that too. Like, I didn't get hardly anything on the show the first 3 weeks I was at Kilbourne. And I'm like, I'm going to get fired here. What am I doing? And then I looked at the jokes and I'm like, oh, they're just tweaking 2 or 3 references down from the prime reference. And I remember the first joke I got on, or maybe Mulcairn or somebody had written this joke about there was a zoo that was trying to figure out why the apes weren't mating. And so they developed a perfume for the male to attract or whatever it was back and forth. And the joke was something like, oh, great. Now this Valentine's Day, I'm going to be fourth in line at the Bed Bath & Beyond behind a silverback.
The silverback's got a good bite to it.
You know, and instead of saying gorilla,
right,
you keep tweaking until you get a cool word. And right. Once I learned that, I'm like, okay, I got it.
You got it. Wow, that's quite a long time. I had the advantage of being a faxer before, so my transition was a little more seamless.
I've been writing at Best Damn, and I've been sending stuff in through you at Kilbourne. So I got the voice, but... You know, guys that are writing it full time are still hitting, they're hitting all the cylinders. And yeah. I was getting punchlines and stuff like that, but it wasn't that full voiced Kilbourne who liked to, you know, have the references and that kind of flavor to it, that ornament to the joke.
Right.
Dennis Miller was the same way, like learning Dennis Miller's wandering towards the punchline and diving off into phrases and descriptions. But
he was really specific with his references, I recall.
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
And you had to get the exact right, you know.
Right.
Like if you're talking about a concerto or something by Beethoven or a symphony by Beethoven, it had to be the right one.
Exactly.
Not that he would know all of that, but
right.
The writers would and, you know.
Well, guys like that made it easier in quotes. Like Kilbourne he liked sports. He was an anchor on ESPN. So you knew if there was a sports story, that was good. He was sort of fraternity frat guy like, and he was self-deprecating. He was like real self-deprecating and faux self-deprecating.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had all these different angles and perspectives you could use, and it made your job easier to go to those places.
Yeah, he could not handle real self-deprecation or deprecation.
Right.
If you remember this, but before I got hired there. I never told Kilborn this, but he came on Best Damn Sports as a guest. And I wrote a joke about him, which was, hey, yeah, you know, most people don't know how good you were at basketball. And he was a great basketball player. He goes, because he played at Montana or somewhere, or Wyoming, yeah. I can't remember what it was. But, you know, like all great basketball players, you had a nickname, you know, in college. And we looked it up, we found it, and you were called the Big Kleenex because you're thin and white and everybody blew right through you. And they told him that joke on Best Damn, and he did not laugh.
That's funny. That's a funny joke. Yeah, of course.
What can you do?
I don't know.
Well, dude, you got to go. It's 4:40.
Wow. Time flies when you're talking about comedy.
Yeah. Well, come back on when you've got more time, and we'll keep wandering through. I enjoy talking to writers. Like I said, the real mechanics inside of things. I think people don't get to them very often.
Yeah. We sometimes feel left out.
Yeah, as long as you get a check, you don't feel that left out.
That's what you care about. No, this has been fun. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. Any words for anybody? They can find you anywhere, hire you to write jokes.
You know, peterchartkalis@gmail.com. I don't think they will remember that. I mean, I don't know if there's a, can I put it up on your site, or will they see my name on your thing?
Yeah, it'll be up there. Charkalis. How can you forget Charkalis?
Yeah, it's Greek for Buttafuoco. Remember that reference? That joke killed every single time I did it. But I haven't done it in like 20 years. I don't
think it would probably still work. Just the word is funny, but if, you know.
It's a funny, you have to use Schwarzenegger or some other, whatever the current funny name is. I don't know.
Yeah. It's Greek for Scarlett Johansson or something. Well, cool, man. I appreciate it. Go do your thing. Everybody, this has been Peter Charkalis. Super fun. Rhetoric warriors, get out there, learn some persuasion, learn how to write up messages. We need it. See you next time.
Thanks, Dan.